He was adamant that he did not see color. No way the situation could have been viewed as racist, he said. I'm the sweetest guy in the world. I don't harbor a racist bone in my body. I love everyone. In fact, he said, if anybody's racist, it's you, Elijah. You're the one that brought race into this. We could have settled it another way, but you had to make everything about race. Color this and color that. Black people this and black people that. You are the real racist here. I don't see color. I had heard him say a version of this before, but I was still a bit stunned hearing it again. As we sat across from our teacher, we were both in trouble because there had been some academic dishonesty in my free enterprise class in high school. And God bless Louisiana, we don't take simple economics. No, we're specific. It's free enterprise. So that's what we were doing. And the way it worked is that first semester, the whole football team took PE together so that we could work out and get a head start on our matches. Second semester, we all took free enterprise together. If you can imagine the dynamics of a Southern American high school football team, you can imagine that this was a particular tense semester to study free enterprise together. And so this particular affair, we were in trouble because our teacher had given us a quiz, and since he thought that we were student leaders, he trusted us to be able to take the quiz while he tended to some other work outside of the classroom. Of course, the moment he left, the students, both black and white, started to pass the answers and cheat on the test. I really didn't participate. I wouldn't lie to y'all 12 years later. They took the test, and after he came back and he graded it, he said that there was something fishy about the test. Immediately, a white student, Chris, raised his hand and said, "Yes, teacher, there is something fishy about this test. Rob, a black kid, was cheating. He was the ringleader and convinced a few of the other kids sitting over there, all black, to cheat. In this version of the story, he, Chris, tried to stop Rob from cheating, but Rob wouldn't listen to him. And so I was stunned. I raised my hand back and I said, Chris wasn't the only one cheating. Rob, you were cheating too, and so was everyone else. And that's when our teacher decided to pull us aside so that he could get to the bottom of this story. He never got to the bottom of the story. Rob said Chris was adamant that he wasn't a cheater. Said, "Look at me. Do I look like someone that cheats?" So we sat there in our teacher's office, and he never got to the bottom of it. Rob was suspended. Everyone had to retake the test, and I was branded the angry black guy for the rest of my time there because I won't forget the words of my classmate, Chris. I don't see color. In her seminal and groundbreaking work, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Color Blindness, Michelle Alexander, the then Ohio State University law professor when she wrote this book, and former ACLU civil rights attorney, and now current professor of social justice at Union Theological Seminary and columnist for the New York Times, argues that mass incarceration is metaphorically the new Jim Crow, as Becca read for us. She says the color blindness and the idea that we have triumphed over race is the glue that holds this new racial caste system together. Her work is systematic and dense, it's vast, profound, far-reaching, so much more time needs to be spent on it. But I want you to hear a bit more from her chapter in the book, The Fire This Time, where she draws the connection between colorblindness and the racial caste system. She says, far from being a worthy goal, colorblindness has proved catastrophic for African Americans. It's not an overstatement to say that the system of mass incarceration of people of color would literally have not been possible in the post-civil rights era if the nation had not fallen under the spell of a callous color blindness. The seemingly innocent phrase, "I don't care if he's black," isn't innocent at all, but instead a form of cruelty. It is precisely because we have not cared much for African Americans that we have allowed our criminal justice system to create a new racial undercast. She continues, the deeply flawed nature of colorblindness is that it purports to see black and brown men as raceless men who have failed miserably to play by the rules that the rest of us follow quite naturally. Colorblindness prevents us from seeing that blacks are punished severely for things that whites do that go unnoticed. Our blindness prevents us from seeing the racial and structural divisions that persist in our society, the segregated, unequal schools, the segregated, jobless ghettos, and the segregated public discourse. We have not just become blind to race, but we have become blind to the racial caste system in America. End quote. This was true in late spring of 2007 when Rob was punished severely by my high school for the things that he and Chris and the whole class did. And it's true in January of 2019. It's true in the workplace, and it's true in schools, it's true in the public discourse, and of course, it's true in our criminal justice system. It is the glue that holds our racial caste system together, and Michelle Alexander helps us to see it. And as she helps us to see it, she joins Jesus in his stated mission of preaching good news to the poor, release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, and liberation for all those oppressed. See, when we turn to the Gospel of Luke, we see the direct line from Jesus to Michelle Alexander. Luke describes the beginning of Jesus' ministry as he is speaking before his home congregation in the synagogue in Nazareth. Luke's audience would have been familiar with this setting. And before Jesus would have spoken, scholars tell us that they would have read the Ten Commandments. There would have been a reading of 18 benedictions. There would have been a reading from the Psalms, a prayer of blessing, and then a reading from the prophets with a teaching to go with it. The synagogue attendant would have picked the scrolls, but the preacher for the morning would be free to pick the particular text that they would expound upon. Luke emphasizes this so that we know that Jesus picked this text that he wanted to preach. Jesus opens up the scroll of Isaiah and finds those words. Jesus wanted this text to be the articulation of his mission and his ministry, so he picked it and he read it, saying, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to preach release to the captives. He has sent me to preach recovery of sight to the blind. He has sent me to let the oppressed go free and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Me, me, me. Jesus has a point that he wants to get across. God has sent Jesus to do those things. And initially, when he says this, the congregation is all for it. No one disapproves of what he reads. But things begin to take a turn as Jesus teaches. The lectionary didn't cover this part, but they get angry with him during his teaching and his preaching. They try to kill him. And before I say more about this, I think it's funny how Jesus is threatened by his own people for living and articulating his truth. I think it's funny that the same people who probably shaped Jesus to be the type of person who would want to read from that portion of Isaiah and order his life around it are now the same people who want to run him out of town for believing it. I think it's funny how sometimes you can get into a lot of trouble for finally articulating who you are and naming the truth about who you are. Calvary, I hope that we are the type of church that remains open to the work that God will do with our children so that we don't respond to Jesus and we don't respond to our children in the way that his home congregation did. I hope that we can be the type of place that affirms vocations and callings of those in our midst. I hope that we can be the type of place who can say yes to the call that God puts on your life. See, Jesus really is the model here. He isn't deterred by rejection at First Church Nazareth. He knows he has a tough word for them, and he shares it with them. Anyway, he tells them that liberation is not theirs alone. He reinterprets a scripture they know well, and he gives it new meaning. He adds universal significance to a particular moment. He challenges their parochialism and seeks to expand their theological imagination. And for this, they seek to kill him. Don't miss what's happening here. Jesus was saying to them, I'm coming to free you, but not just you, prisoners and orphans and widows and those drowning in debt. I'm coming to liberate Israel and Judea and Palestine and Samaria. I'm coming to liberate those whose labor is exploited and those who don't have any labor. I'm coming to liberate those who have been faithful to the law and those who have been a little bit lax with the law. I'm coming to do the work that Mary sang about, that Zechariah prayed about, that John preached about. I'm coming to do my Father's business, to preach good news to the poor. Release to all of those who are in bondage. Recovery of sight for the blind to proclaim today as the year of the Lord's favor. What should have been a joyful message for this set of oppressed people wasn't, because they were so attached to a gospel that placed them at the center and they could not handle all of those other people crowding their space. Jesus knew this, and yet he kept agitating and poking holes in their vapid world view. He knew that he was provoking them to see the world around them, to see their neighbors, and to see the stories of their neighbors and the suffering of their neighbors. Jesus wanted them to be able to see beyond their own pain and to see someone else's. Jesus wanted them to be able to see the underclass in their midst, to see those who linger and live at the margins of society. In a real sense, Jesus was chastising them for living as though they were the only ones there. Jesus was chastising them for being blind to the color of their neighbors. Jesus was chastising them for being blind to the color of their neighbors. Jesus was chastising them for being blind to the colors of their neighbors' oppression, the colors of those suffering beyond their borders. Jesus was asking them to see the whole world in living color. Jesus was urging them to see the skin tones of the oppressed. Jesus was pushing them to notice the faces of the marginalized. Jesus was pushing them to hear the pitches of the cries of the oppressed, to feel the veins and the wounds of the bloody. Jesus was trying to get them to see the world as it is, so that they could create together the world as it ought to be. Do you see the world in living color? Do you notice the patterns of the skin tones of the oppressed? Have you taken in the faces of the marginalized? Do you hear the pitches of those who cry out for mercy? Have you touched the wounds of any of those bloodied by racial and gender-based violence? Do you see the racial caste system in America that Michelle Alexander points us to? Do you see the immigration status-based caste system in America? Do you feel the pain of those pressed up on the walls of our society? Do you see the world in living color? Do you see America as it is, a place where racial caste and racial violence and racial terror reign supreme and controls the lives of millions of America's disinherited children? Do you see America as it is yet? See, the questions that Jesus asked of his congregation were too hard. They couldn't see the world as it was. So they couldn't be a part of the world as what it could be. Part of why they couldn't see the world as it was is because, as one commentator puts it, inside of that synagogue, there was a struggle over how to read Scripture. They were familiar with the text, Chris, but Jesus reinterpreted the text in a way that they were not familiar with. Would they read the text as they had always read it, or would they read it in this new way that Jesus pushed them? Would they read the Scripture and include the suffering of those below and outside and on the margins of their system, or would they act as they were the only ones there? Would they see the Scriptures in living color? Would they hear Isaiah's voice and the voices of the poor, the voices of the oppressed, the voices of the indebted, the voices of the enslaved, the voices of the bound people living in their midst? In that synagogue, there was a struggle over how to read Scripture. I'm almost done, but I gotta ask y'all this before I go. How do you read Scripture? Do you read Scripture in living color? Do you read Scripture and see the oppressed and the oppressors? Do you ask, who am I in this text? Do you go to Scripture to help you make sense of the world that we live in? Do you read Scripture exclusively for your benefit and those around you? Or do you read it for the liberation beyond our own borders? In fact, liberation that might call us to fight even against some of our own instincts. How do you read Scripture? Let's not miss the point here, because this is huge. This puts into perspective all of the work that we do at a place like this, all of the urgency that is behind me and Sally and Maria, and the type of things that we try to push in this place, the types of fights that we want to have, the types of arguments that we have with religious evangelicals and Christian conservatives and theological homophobes and people who think that Trump is cute, or that those high schoolers were innocent, or that there's more to theology than liberation, or that we're too urgent for social justice, too intense to only focus on race, and we do too much by pressing a historically white congregation to take seriously the ideas and works of Black and Latinx women because of how we read Scripture. Yes. And what we think is at stake over how you read Scripture. In that synagogue was a struggle over how to read Scripture. And in America, there is a struggle over how to read Scripture. Do you read it for the liberation of those inside and outside of our borders, or do you read it for something else? That is what is at stake And that is how Jesus articulates his own mission. Dr. Jacqueline Grant, the womanist theologian, says it this way. Jesus uses his own voice to describe what his ministry will be. In his own words, Jesus says that his work is to free humans from bondage. Economic, political, social, psychological, and theological. In his own voice, Jesus tells us how we ought to read Scripture. In his own voice, Jesus pushes us to read Scripture in living color, to see the shapes, the heights, the depths, the pains of our world and overlay it onto the biblical text. We must read Scripture in living color. We must practice Christianity in living color. We must read Scripture and practice Christianity under the direction of people like Michelle Alexander, whose work illuminating the racial caste system in America, more recently in the New York Times op-ed from last week, challenging the state of Israel for their treatment of Palestinians, helps us to see better the world as it is. We must read Scripture in living color and practice Christianity under the direction of Audre Lorde and bell hooks, who help us to see how policing of gender and sexuality is connected to the policing and trafficking of bodies. We must read Scripture and practice Christianity under the direction of Dr. M. Sean Copeland and Bishop Yvette Flunder and Dr. Dolores Williams and Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas and Dr. Michelle Guidry and Dr. Ebony Marshall Turman, who center Black women's experiences as the starting point for doing theology. We must read Scripture and practice Christianity in living color, because God is in living color. And that is the only way to see her, to know her, to love her, to serve her, and to be saved.